Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 170 for November 24th, 2008. Mile High Wi-Fi. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. And by GoToMeeting. For your free 30-day trial, visit gotomeeting.com/twit. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it. It's time for TWiT, a chance to talk about the latest tech news with some of the smartest, wisest, most attractive tech journalists in the industry. What are you laughing at? Ryan Block from Gadget, GDGT. You're one of them.
I would attest to most of those things. Maybe not attractive.
Good looking fella.
I'll go with, you know, intelligent.
That's intelligent, fine. Smart. GDGT.com. Ryan also does a podcast with Peter Rojas, his co-host and what do you call him? Co-owner?
Co-founder. Yeah, he's the co-founder, co-owner, same thing.
Of GDGT.com. Good to have you back, Ryan.
Hi.
Brian Rock, I'm going to call you.
It's a wrestler name.
Brian Rock. Tom Merritt is also here from Buzz Out Loud and CNET and CBS Interactive.
Right. All of those things and more.
And more. And the Sword and the Laser.
Swordandlaser.com.
Good to have you back, Tom. I missed you.
Thanks, Lee.
Yeah. Also here in studio with us, always glad to welcome Mr. Alex Lindsay from the Pixel Corps. You'll be here a lot more now that you live a block away. So, Ryan, you were on the Virgin. It was a Virgin America's first Wi-Fi flight?
It's not the first Wi-Fi flight ever. The company who's providing service is called Aircell, and the service they're providing is called GoGo, just in case anyone's curious as to what they should be looking out for. So this GoGo service has been active on a couple of other airlines in very, very limited release, Delta, American, Air Canada. I think they all have like a plane or two that are being outfitted. But Virgin America is the first airline that is rolling it out fleet-wide. So within the next couple of months, they're going to have every single plane will have Wi-Fi.
Oh, I love Virgin America, but I like them even more.
Yeah,
now.
I know. It's as if you didn't already have reason enough to fly them.
Yeah.
Now it's just, it's all on.
Come for the disco balls, stay for the Wi-Fi. No Wi-Fi.
I will definitely give you that. It is one of those moments where you can kind of catch up on reading or on email or whatever. Just it's, you know, one of those chances to just completely disconnect and not having that choice. Then again,
right.
You don't have to fly Virgin America. And, you know, frankly, you don't have to turn on your Wi-Fi and pay for it.
True.
That's
good
a
point.
Really good point. You don't have to. I was wondering, Ryan, did they explain how they get around the issue of having Wi-Fi radios on? Because it's something, if you're on a plane that doesn't have Wi-Fi, they make you turn off the Wi-Fi radios on your laptop usually.
You know, I didn't really ask them too much about that. I think it's kind of an open secret, though, that
they were lying all this time.
Yeah, the FAA does that to be really, you know, they try to restrict wireless signals to be as conservative as possible. And there's a lot of spectrum that just doesn't go anywhere near the communications traffic from a plane. So the actual signals they have going to the plane that are providing the data to the Wi-Fi, to the in-cabin data, is EVDO. I mean, it's
oh, really?
Their spectrum.
It's EVDO. It's not. That's how they're connecting to the ground station.
Exactly. So it's 3.6 megabits downstream and 1.8
for the whole cabin.
For the whole cabin. I can talk a little bit about how, what that was like, you know, being in that cabin and sharing it with everybody because it is a shared connection.
Was it a full flight?
It was a full flight. It was a press flight, so 100% saturation. Everybody on the plane was using the Wi-Fi. So it was about as bad as you could possibly imagine,
and
it was still great.
Really?
Yeah, it was wonderful. I had no real complaints. I mean, yeah.
You said you were able to get on the Pirate Bay?
I didn't say what torrents I was downloading, but I did. I actually tested downloading a torrent, and it did work. Here's the thing, though. They said that Aircel, who's providing the GoGo service, said that they want to cut off chat, so VoIP, you know, iChat, that kind of stuff.
No IM?
No. They do the IM is fine.
Just
but
video
they don't
chat.
Want to do audio or video streams. Mm. Not even because the bandwidth couldn't handle it, because I think that it can. I mean, wow. It's not that I think it can. It can. I mean, I saw it. I tested it. You know, I was doing BitTorrenting. I was sitting next to my pal Brian Lamb, the editor of, the assistant editorial director over at Gawker and Gizmodo, and he was testing iChat and it was working fine. So you can do it, and the latency is not that bad. I could be recording Twit from 35,000 feet if I wanted to.
Wow.
It's actually that they're doing it out of courtesy and respect for the other passengers.
Yeah, nobody wants to hear somebody going, and then I said, and that's why I don't want cell phones on flights. The same
exactly.
thing.
And they were pretty upfront about that. They were like, look, we're choosing to block this off because we don't, you know, we don't want people just gabbing
right.
on phone or on chat or on.
Do they still have, you know, cell phones in there? Is that the other reason, right? Because they want to charge you the $8 a minute for the cell phone.
No, there's no, Virgin America doesn't have any.
They don't have phones.
No, as far as I know, all airlines have had those shut down, and that spectrum has since been allocated to data.
Oh, really?
The whole intention here was to kind of take out all those in-flight cell phones. All those licenses have been expired, and that spectrum was auctioned off, I believe, last year. So that's what this.
I didn't know that. So you mean that phone in the back of the seat that hasn't worked for a year?
Yeah.
You don't fly Air. You don't fly Air Canada. They don't take nothing out. They'd have now. They didn't have a hole in the seat. What are they going to do?
They still
with
have
that?
Ashtrays.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, I didn't realize that. So
yeah. So it's you know, it's been it worked really well. It's $10 for flights under 3 hours and $13 for flights $10. Over 3 hours. In my opinion, totally worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again,
worth it, but also a huge profit center for them. My God.
Oh man, they're going to make so much money.
Oh my God.
So they're going to make so much money. Is ridiculous.
I was on an SAS flight two or 3 years ago that had Wi-Fi transatlantic, and I used it off and on. But you know, after a while, after the novelty wears off, you don't really want to be online all the time, do you?
I like to be. You know, I have a 10-hour flight or 11-hour flight on Tuesday. No, I work the whole time. I mean, that's usually the one isolated time that I have is to. Where nothing's bothering me, I actually probably get most of our planning and all of our text written.
Why did it take so long in the U.S.? Because Lufthansa's had this for years.
Yeah, Boeing has had a subcompany called Connection, and it's been rolled out in parts of Europe and stuff like that. Here's the thing, though. There's a couple of bits. First of all, since this is a U.S. service and there isn't really any way except by satellite to get internet access if you're, say, flying over the ocean. You can't expect this to work if you're flying out of the country. Now, Virgin America doesn't have any international flights, so it's not a big deal.
SAS worked across the Atlantic, so I guess they were using a different technology.
Right, so they might be
able to... Most of them use satellites, yeah. Most of the international flights.
Here's the thing about that working condition is, and that, you know, disconnectivity, so to speak, is here's what you got to do. You know, it's not really anybody's business what airline you're flying. You know, and if you're on,
you don't
a 12-
have to tell them you're on Virgin Atlantic with
yeah,
full
exactly.
Wi-Fi.
You're on a 12-hour flight. Just be like, look, you know, I'm taking a flight tomorrow. I'm going to be offline. You know?
I did that.
You can do all your web surfing. You know, you can check your email and stuff like that. Just don't respond.
I used
and
to just make
that.
Sure Skype is turned off. I always, you know, it's hard. I always forget, right. And then suddenly I'm there. I'm there.
When
yeah,
I was,
mean, your presence is your choice. You know, you can turn off AIM and still be browsing the web and checking your news feeds and stuff like that because that's what I'd be doing. And that's my biggest problem is I get off the plane. Like, you know, I have like 1,000 news articles unread. It's a big pain.
I would go when I would go to Canada. I would say I would actually put a responder on my mail. I'm going out of the country. I won't be reachable.
Right.
Like I'm going to the darkest continent. I'm going to be in Toronto. I don't know if they have internet there, so don't you know? And I would have a week that I didn't have to answer email. I loved that.
I mean, the big deal here is not that Virgin is the first to have Wi-Fi. I mean, almost all the airlines have at least announced experimentation with it, and some of them already have it. It's that they are going to roll it out on all their planes by the middle of the next year. Is that their big hook that they're pushing?
Yeah, pretty much. And there's actually a couple of other little things that that aren't really being talked about. One is that they're not filtering traffic, and they're the only airline that's not filtering traffic. So if you're on American and you go to a site that is quote-unquote questionable and... You never know what sites are considered questionable. I mean, you know, Boing Boing is by many standards considered a questionable site. You might not be able to access it. They filter that traffic. They will actually be looking for questionable material. Virgin has said that they're not going to do that at all. So you could technically be browsing, you know, adult material. Not that I would recommend doing so. I mean, it might be you know, offensive to the people sitting next to you, but
well, that was that, one of the reasons the other airlines justified is they didn't want to have the flight attendants responding to complaints from people. This person next to me surfing porn, and so why they said put the filter.
Sometimes I'll watch a movie with a nude scene, and I'll go whoa, and I'll cover it up. I mean, you know, people have laptops with them; they're going to have stuff on their laptops.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like that individual, you know, couldn't have already just loaded their laptop up with questionable material and started watching and reviewing it abroad. Browsing with it or whatever, even offline. I mean, if somebody wants to do that in a public place, internet connectivity or no, they'll, you know, they can do that. So the whole, like, I'm going to filter your traffic is just kind of silly to me. It's just a pain.
What kind of filter are they using?
I don't know exactly what the filtering solution that they're using or, you know, who is building their whitelist. But I also know that one of the things that they're doing is some traffic shaping. So basically, if you're like, if you're abusing the traffic and the system, they won't kick you off because you did pay, but they'll scale you back.
I mean, American or Virgin?
Well, I think this is pervasive across all of the GoGo installs on any airline.
GoGo.
So if there are 10 people using the traffic, then, you know, everybody would get 360K, you know, if they were all using all of their bandwidth at the same time. It would equal that out. But one of the coolest things that we're talking about is if you're on a red eye and everybody's asleep and you just happen to be up at 4 in the morning and you're using the internet, you get, you know, as much bandwidth as there is. So it's proportionate to how many users are on the connection.
Where can I get 3.6 megabit EVDO? I'd like to try that.
Yeah.
What cell company offers that?
Aircell.
So I didn't. Exactly. So I guess that I thought EVDO was limited 1.5 megabits. I guess maybe
I was. I'm getting faster than that.
That's what they cap.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I'm getting 2.2. I think at times.
Speaking of 2.2, did you put the new iPhone?
I did.
How do you like the Street View?
The Street View is the best implementation that I could imagine. You know, I mean, it was like, I expected it to be some kind of clunky, like I couldn't find it when I first started because I was trying to roll up the page. Like, and I was like, where's the Street View? And I realized, oh, it's that little.
Drop a pin, baby.
Well, you drop the pin and then there's this little button there and you just hit that little button, the little person button or whatever. And right. And I love the way it kind of flies into it. I was looking at it at Petaluma right here, actually.
I just say Google is owning the iPhone. I don't know what the G1's doing, but Google's right. Between the voice search. Of course, you have a better Street View on the G1.
Yeah, right? And you have the compass thing on the right. G1 where Which you can actually cool. turn it around. But my thing is, other than the G-Wiz factor, what is the big excitement I like? About having Street View on the
phone? I do it a lot. I'll tell you what I use Street View for a lot is verifying. Because, like, for instance, I want to go to a Starbucks or I want to go to a Pete's or whatever, and you'll see a whole bunch of them show up on a – like, you'll search an address and you'll say, show me a coffee shop or whatever, and you'll see, like, six of them. And there's really only three of them there. They've either moved or it's inaccurate or whatever. And so I'll use the Street View a lot to make sure that there's a building, at least when that car went by, that says Starbucks on it.
You're the Ronald Reagan of fast food. Trust but verify. using Street View.
Exactly. Well, it's morning in America, so he needs his coffee.
Hallelujah. The other good thing, I love transit directions. I mean, you must like
that. Transit directions are brilliant. Yeah. They're so well done.
I love that.
Gives you the dollar amount. It tells you what trains to take when those trains are arriving. That's
I want to test it when I'm in France. I presume it would work worldwide. I'd love to see.
I'm going to test it in Japan next week.
See if that.
Well, and pedestrian directions. It used to be you'd have to take, you know, the stupid
take the highway.
Car directions and figure out, okay, right. what I really need to do is just go, you know, straight there. And now you get the I've been using that on the website for a long time, and I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I think a great idea. Yeah.
You know, I will say this, having played with, I have a G1 and I have an iPhone 3G. In fact, I'm playing with the implementation on the G1. The 3G implementation is better. It's nicer. It works faster, and I have to say it's smoother animation.
You're saying that T-Mobile 3G is better? Than
no,
AT&T's?
No, I'm saying that the iPhone 3G.
Oh, the iPhone's better.
Their implementation of Street View is better than Google's own implementation of Street
Precisely.
View on their device.
What's Google doing? Why?
Well, it could be just a matter of teams. You know, different. Yeah. You know, it's not like it's a central team. It's probably there's a team working on the iPhone apps. There's a team working.
Right.
On the
no. Well, Apple actually develops all their iPhone apps. So the Google Maps app is not developed by Google.
It's an Apple thing.
Right. By the Apple team. Same thing with the Google mobile app is not developed by Apple. It's developed by Google.
Yeah, I talked to the guy who actually.
Yeah, the Google Maps and the YouTube app are both actually developed by Apple.
Yeah, Alcorn worked on that.
The thing I like better about the 2.2 firmware is the direct downloads of podcasts. Yeah, the ability to get the new episode when you're like, oh, I forgot to sync.
As podcasters, we love that.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything terribly revolutionary in 2.2. It's some nice to have.
I think downloading podcasts from a podcaster point of view is revolutionary.
It could open things up very quickly, because I know that it's something that I think about. I'll be somewhere and I'll think, oh, I really want to want to listen to that. And I go, oh, I'll have to go back to my computer and I'll have to do this thing.
I think
and,
you're limited to 10 megs if it's 3G, right?
Right. Yeah. If you're on Wi-Fi, there's no limit.
The Wi-Fi, you can do as much as you want. That's to keep people from having 8,000.
Well, but the problem is that the subscriptions aren't pervasive. So what you're subscribed to on your desktop is not carried over. So if you haven't gotten the latest episode, the last time that you synced, your device does not know that. So you have to kind of know to go check
to if
there's an episode and then download it.
But it's really not that hard. I did it this afternoon. I was out with the dog and I was wanting to listen to Extra Life Radio and I didn't have the latest episode. And I was like, oh, crap, I forgot to sync. And then I remembered, oh, I can press this button. And while I was driving, it downloaded the episode. So I went out for the walk and we got to the park. I had it.
I think that's pretty cool. So it launches the iTunes store, right? Is that how it does it?
Yeah.
So you go to your podcasts, whatever you've got on here, GDGT or Sword and Laser Pointer, and then you say, I'm sorry, I had to do that. And then you say at the bottom, get more episodes. You press get more episodes. Then it launches the iTunes store, shows you a list. So you're saying because it shows you the list of, oh, it didn't work on that one. Huh. I don't know what happened there.
Here's the important thing, I think, though, that we have to kind of put in perspective with what Apple is doing, and that is that if you look at every single smartphone OS that has come out in the last decade, Palm, Windows Mobile, or, you know, before it was called Windows Mobile, is Windows CE and Windows CE.net. times. You've got Android, you've got Symbian, you've got UIQ. There's this plethora of smartphone platforms, and they're all good in their own right, and they all have their advantages and disadvantages. But none have been as aggressive and as, so quick to add new features and expand on the functionality of the platform as Apple has with the iPhone.
Which is funny because we complain a lot about how they're not going fast enough.
Well, they still don't have cut and paste.
And background processes and all these things, but I agree, yeah. Ryan.
Those are design decisions, and I think that it's important to kind of, put those off in a different corner than they're choosing not to. I mean, yes, granted, it is a choice not to do it, but those are choices. It's not like they haven't implemented copy and paste because it just hasn't been on their radar. It's really, I think, for them, it's been a design decision. They haven't, found an implementation that they think works elegantly.
Any implementation would work.
T-Mobile Storm, nice implementation. You tap it, it does it. G1, tap it. How do you like the Storm?
The G1 implementation is not that good because
it's limited.
Works on text.
It's not everywhere, so that's kind of a problem. How about the Storm? That's got full cut and paste, right?
It does have copy and paste, yeah.
Yeah. Copy and paste.
It also has background processes.
Yep.
Which the iPhone actually has. I mean, if you're using the iPod, it's a background process. It runs in the background while you're doing other stuff. Yeah. So it's capable of doing it. They just don't allow it.
Only Apple.
I think it could greatly affect battery power. You know, if you start you start running those processes.
Well, I have to say the G1's battery life is awful. I mean, it's unusable.
Yeah, and it's something we're already seeing with the G1 because the G1, it comes, by default. It's looking on location. It's got apps in the background that are looking for location. It's got push Gmail, between the Wi-Fi, the cellular, all that stuff. I mean, it is one of the most, abysmal battery life experiences on any mobile device out there right now. And it's the battery life that's actually the worst part of the G1. Everything else that, they got fairly well. But that battery life is just terrible.
How about the Storm? How's the battery life on the Storm? Is it okay?
I haven't actually gotten to play with the Storm yet.
What?
So
me neither.
Yeah.
Tom, you must have gotten a Storm. You're with the CBS.
Yeah, I haven't got my hands on it myself. No,
Verizon is not that
for CNET.
I'm gonna let you in on a little gadget industry secret. Verizon is not very pro press.
No.
They don't really do a lot of outreach.
I was quite
usually they only do at the behest of the gadget companies. Right. And here's another little secret for you. RIM is also not pro press. They don't do a lot of outreach. It was actually, I think somebody from a gadget was at a dinner with Basili, co-CEO of RIM. This is like last year, and talking about a gadget. And he's like, what's a gadget?
Thanks for paying attention.
Maybe that doesn't matter. You know, I guess maybe that sounds a little silly coming from the former editor of Engadget. But
no, but
in Engadget world, if you don't know what Engadget is, that means that you've basically been under a boulder for the last.
No. If you're a cell phone guy, you really ought to know who the big players are.
Yeah. I kind of feel like the Bold is a better choice than the Storm anyway.
I like the Bold. I do like
People
the Bold
have been
a lot.
Really fond of the Bold so far.
Yeah,
I like it. It's a little bit kind of a brickish to me. It's a lot thicker than I think it needed to be.
Yeah, you know what's in your hand. None of that guessing. None of that slim and trim guessing. It's interesting when we're talking about the differences between how Apple, implements things on the iPhone and what we've got going on with BlackBerry. It sort of fits into that old pattern that Umberto Eco identified between DOS and Mac. DOS being the Protestants and Mac being the Catholics. Mac has always, and Apple has always granted you, this is what you do. You play by these rules. You will be happy. Just trust us. You'll have good battery life. Don't complain. And DOS was always the, go anywhere, do whatever right. you want. It's up to you. You know, your sins are on your own head. And that's essentially, in a little less extreme way, the difference between, a BlackBerry and a Palm versus the iPhone. The iPhone says, no, you want good battery life, so we're not going to let you do right. these things. BlackBerry's like, hey, it's up to you. Your battery runs out. You shouldn't have used.
You can change your battery on a BlackBerry.
You can change it.
Right.
Yeah. And you have the freedom to do that.
There are very few BlackBerry apps. I mean, they're out there, but not too many people use them, and they're all pretty much sandbox, and they're more or less Java based. So you can't do a whole lot with them. It's not the same nature of apps. I mean, BlackBerry, I guess, is technically a smartphone, but it's not a smartphone in the depth that you think of a Palm device or a Windows Mobile device or the G1 with Android as being a smartphone. I mean, those are on a whole other level, and you get really kind of low level access to some of that hardware. Not really the same on the BlackBerry.
And how many apps do you guys download for the iPhone?
For the iPhone, 8 pages. Yeah, I mean, it goes on.
I mean,
and
how
on.
Often? How often do you? App?
Every day. I downloaded another one yesterday.
Yeah, a few a week. Maybe not every day.
You're gonna hate me because I'm gonna show you desktop tower defense.
No, I got it.
You got it.
After we talked about it on Mac.
Somebody
break,
sent me an email.
I got I got more than one.
Field runners. Field runners is awesome.
Yeah.
No, what's interesting though is that this is I would estimate some of the best attach rate of software to a mobile device that we've ever seen.
I agree.
There are some really hardcore smartphone users out there, but in terms of per capita, I think that there's more apps installed per device on the iPhone platform.
Well, so easy.
Compare the experience. Exactly.
Yeah, it's part of the App Store, and that's why the other guys are doing that.
Look at Handango. It's a painful experience to buy. And even, I have to say, even the G1 store is still nowhere near the elegance of the Apple Store.
Well, I think that how much I'm paying and everything else is so hidden behind things that I tend to just go, I'll get that.
It's free.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful cathedral, wonderful ceremony in the Apple Church. You're going to love it. You don't need all that freedom. You just abuse it.
Hey, talking about print, did you see this PC Magazine? Of course you did. Everybody saw it. No more print edition.
Yes, I saw Jim Lauterbach the other day in a bar, and we raised a glass.
Yeah. I'll raise my coffee mug. Raise a brain tonic.
Classic of an era.
This was the most powerful computer publication ever. When Spencer the Cat, well, that was actually PC Week,
Spencer F.
but it was Ziff Davis, when he threw a party at CES, or Comdex, everybody was there, including Bill Gates, PC Magazine's Michael Miller, editor-in-chief, the most powerful guy in the business, a million, I think it went up to 1.2 or 1.3 million circ. This was dominant, and now they're giving up print, they're going to continue with the website.
You got to remember, that was a different time, though, Leo. I mean, that was
4 years ago.
No. Yeah, it was a higher circ, 90s, early aughts. But again, this is before blogs really came onto the scene. There were not as many.
You're probably as much responsible for killing it as anybody, Ryan Block.
Yeah. Well,
it's all your fault.
When it came out, I Twittered that, then the news came out, I Twittered that it bums me out. But there's a couple of bits of silver linings here. First, they killed it before it killed itself, which is important.
Yep.
I mean, they could have just let the brand drive itself into the ground, but they didn't. And then secondly, and most importantly, they're not shutting down operations. They're moving everything to the web, which is what they should be doing anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Ryan. It's PCMag.com is still around.
It's not only around, but they actually do some really amazing content there. And and the people who I know who work there are excellent. It's funny how it's a misnomer because it's PCMag.com, you know, and it's clearly not a magazine anymore.
Right.
And the magazine brand doesn't really make a lot of sense. But I mean, look, they do a good job. They've got a lot of great editors, a lot of great talent. And as far as publications go, you know, on the web, they're top notch. And I'm glad that they're still around. And I'm glad they're putting 100% of the resources where it needs to be, because frankly, people who are interested in technology are not buying paper magazines.
No,
they're absolutely.
Well, I think this was an issue. Like when you looked at Tech TV, as you know, you saw Tech TV going on to cable, and you were like, where it really belonged was on the web.
From day one, I said, why are we building a brick and mortar business? Right. You know, this is crazy. This is the past. But Tom Merritt, is this the kind of the canary in the mine for other print magazines?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the tech guys are the first to, you know, to adopt this web. This thing called the internet.
Well, we're some of the first magazines to go online. They were the tech magazines.
Right.
So this is kind of a big deal when you step back. It's like, look, a print entity decided that its business can subsist entirely online. It doesn't need a print adjutant, for lack of a better word. It doesn't need a print edition of itself.
Right.
So is that going to be true of The Economist? Is that going to be true of, you know, someday Vanity Fair?
I think there are a lot of publications that lend themselves to having print print magazines. I don't think that this is a rule that is going to
Life magazine will never go out of business because it's all pictures. It's very
I thought they were out of business.
Oh, never mind.
What exactly,
Ryan? I mean, I'll tell you, the only magazines will be around in 10 years will be the ones sold at the grocery checkout line.
The Star,
The Globe, Us Magazine, Entertainment Weekly.
When you look at that tech section in the, you know, your Barnes & Noble or Borders where they have the huge magazine areas, and I always look at those and I'm like amazed. I'm like, really? There's this many magazines still?
Yeah.
It's the niche ones that people still buy for whatever reason.
Well, I'd say that
there's the tons funny thing of is those, Windows
those niche
and
ones
Linux.
Won't really matter because, you know, as blogs and publications start going to micro niche, I mean, you've got a photography magazine. Well, screw the photography magazine. I want a photography photography blog that's only about Canon lenses.
Yeah, I want the Canon lens,
access that blog every single place I am.
Well, that's the thing. You're right.
Magazine.
And that's why I think the grocery line is going to stick around. There'll be bathroom reading, maybe not even airplane reading anymore after our first story.
Yeah, for me, it's like when we're taking off and landing, you know, on an airplane, bathroom, yeah, like and when my battery dies.
You can't have your Kindle on during takeoff and landing. Yeah,
somebody told me for the first time that his Kindle was turned. The stewardess said, turn off your Kindle, please.
Because you know those are dangerous.
You never know.
You know.
Boy, that Kindle could bring a plane down.
I actually tell them that it's off and that because it's yank, that it just looks like
and
it's
on. And do they buy
you
that?
You have to live with yourself.
They usually leave you alone after that.
Really?
Yeah, no, you can. Well, you can pop out the battery. You can open up the back and take out the battery.
Look,
and then the screen
no
is still on. They're like, oh, crap, maybe this guy's right.
He is Ryan Block, you know.
Take that, flight attendant.
I like to be really passive aggressive with that stuff. Stick my...
Well, I know that for me, looking at these at magazines, if I could get stuff like The Economist and, you know, there's a handful of other magazines that I read, I'd vastly prefer to have them, you know, on my iPhone, to be
we
honest.
Would. It makes me mad that I can't get The New Yorker on the Kindle. I mean, that's just a natural place for it.
Some things I don't want to read on an iPhone. That's a small screen. Big enough e-paper, like that one they show that's like, you know, 8.5 by 11, eight size paper. Something thin, allows me to switch pages, you know, can update itself rapidly.
How long before that comes out?
I mean, it's here. It's just a matter of the business plan.
Now,
the technology is available.
E-ink that is actually would be a mass market substitute for paper is not here.
Okay. I think we're really talking about people in our generation. Yes. I mean, you know, my kids aren't going to care.
There is a display now that is, you know, updatable and high resolution that can do it. It's too expensive and nobody wants to jump on that bandwagon.
It needs to be color. It needs to be thin.
Yeah,
and it needs. I don't necessarily think that it needs to be flexible. I think people don't necessarily. I mean, flexible is great.
It needs to be unbreakable.
No, isn't this really happening though?
It needs to be thin. It needs to be color, and it needs to refresh faster than, you know, a quarter of a second.
I mean, that's the part that is hard. They can make them color and they can make them thin, but the refresh rate's still pretty low.
Isn't this really happening though? Not because of consumer preference, but because advertising. Are abandoning print. Or is it, or the magazines are too expensive, the newsprint, the paper's too expensive, the ink's too expensive, the truck to deliver it. Yeah, ink's expensive.
Ink is like more expensive than gold.
Yeah. Especially if you use a Lexmark printer.
and it gets even more expensive in a printer.
Yeah.
So the economies of printing are, it's all of those things. Yeah. And the fact
so it's
that
not consumer preference we're talking about here. It's economics we're talking about.
I think it's both. I don't think it's one or the other. I mean, definitely consumer preference for wide ranging magazines like that has gone down. There's no doubt about it. They're still out there for the more niche magazines. Hilarious. At least that's the evidence that I see. But something like a PC Mag that covers so wide of an aspect, people are like, well, I get it other places, whether it's another magazine or, like Brian has pointed out, you can get a blog on any subject you want.
Well, anything that's timely, anything that's a narrow cast, you want on the web. I mean, even when PC Magazine went to twice a month, it still had, I think, an unusable lead time. Well,
but I also think, you know, I look at, I mean, I read the New York Times every morning, you know, on the way,
Kindle,
on the bus, but I don't pick up the paper. I mean, I see the paper at the coffee shop or whatever in the morning, but the idea that I have to carry it around and open it up and
so
everything
else.
You use
your Kindle for that?
No. I use either my iPhone or I use my computer on, yeah, you know, with EVDO on the bus or whatever, but I'd much rather, you know, I can very quickly to get to all the things I can get to. Maybe if I missed yesterday's or whatever, I can relink, you know, find all the links. I don't want to deal with the paper anymore. I
mean, it's not hard on your eyes to read a lot, or is it just that the time is limited enough that it doesn't?
No, I mean, I read for an hour. I mean, I basically go through all of my RSS feeds on the bus in the morning. It's about an hour.
You know, that's why
it doesn't really bother me at all.
I think everybody should be listening to Audible.com because it's easy on your eyes. It's your ears that you care about. It's listening. That's, I tell you, I spent more time on the bus listening to Audible books. I love that. And you know, and you just close your eyes and relax and enjoy.
When are you on the bus?
What?
Do you take the bus down?
Not anymore.
I take the bus to San Francisco.
Alex does because he's
there's an
here.
Express bus, so it picks up here and goes
to take
straight
that
down.
Bus. It was a great bus.
It's awesome because it's direct.
Audible.com. This is a commercial now, just to awesome. Warn people who I segued into it so smoothly, I might have fooled you. Audible.com/twit2. That's a special URL for the Audible Platinum plan. The Audible Platinum plan allows you to subscribe and get two books a month. And when you do that, you're going to get two books right up front, absolutely free. Well, two credits. Many great choices on there. Do you do, when you do Sword and Laser, do you do recommend also the audio versions of those sci-fi books?
Actually, Audible was nice enough to throw some freebies towards Sword and Laser listeners. So we don't make, I mean, they're not paying us, so we don't make a big deal out of it. But yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons is that Audible has, actually they've built studios in their headquarters in New Jersey, and they are recording a lot of these sci-fi books that were never recorded. Because, you know, I mean, sci-fi publishers aren't exactly, you know, I mean, they don't record it. We barely got paper to put this thing on. So they have started this thing called Audible Frontiers, where they're recording some of the best classic science fiction, in many cases for the first time. When I first joined Audible in 2001, that's one thing I looked for is where's the sci-fi? And there wasn't a lot. Now it's unlimited. There's just a ton of great science fiction. What are you reading on Sword and Laser this week?
We are currently reading Memoirs Found in a Bathtub by Stanislaw Lem.
I love Stanislaw Lem.
Yeah, I love him. I'm a big
fan.
Oh,
man. I think he's kind of underrated. Well, not underrated, but not so well known, is he?
Yeah, he's not as well known. So it was Veronica had a pick. Well, before Anathem, Veronica had a pick. So this was my pick. And I tried to find something.
And did Anathem, was that like a 3-month long read?
Practically, yeah.
unfortunately, there's no Stanislaw of Lem on Audible yet. I'm sure that's something that they're working to address. There's a sci-fi radio series that he wrote. That's kind of interesting. But
by the way, Veronica wanted me to mention, for anyone interested in Veronica and maybe even interested in speaking with her, she couldn't make it on the show today. She has a head cold, but she's actually she's auctioning a half an hour of her time off to do a video chat with someone.
She's doing Humanity, huh?
Exactly. humanety.com. And that charity goes to Child's Play, which is an awesome charity for sick children to get them video games. So you can hang out, talk with the co-host of Sword and Laser, Core, Techzilla. She does all those shows and more.
She's the current auction right now.
She is the current auction, yes.
Gary Vaynerchuk is next. Felicia Day. Scott Bourne's going to do it. John C. Dvorak's going to do it. Dick DiBartolo did it. It's a really neat idea. I think this is a...
Molly and I are going to do it, too.
Are you?
I think I'm on the list somewhere.
HUMANETY.com. This is like a turducken. We put a PSA in the middle of a commercial. Now all we need is a commercial in the middle of the PSA in the middle of the commercial, and it will be a turducken. Maybe I'll do a commercial for turducken in the middle of the PSA.
Boom!
Audible.com/twit2 for your platinum. Pick a book, two books, if you want. Anathem is a two, I think it's a true credit book. Boy, is that a good way to read Anathem, just to listen to it. It's kind of partly dramatized. It's multiple voices. Just fantastic. I've recommended it before. I loved. Did you like, what'd you think of it, Tom?
I loved it.
I thought it was great.
It took about 100 pages to really get cruising, and then I was sucked in and really enjoyed it. I know it's a lot for some people. Some people think it's a little too pretentious, and it is. But the world he created was just crazy.
Took me 250 pages.
Yeah.
To really get into it. But boy, you know, it's Neal Stephenson. When you read Neal Stephenson, you say, I'm going to take some time here. I'm going to spend some time with this. He did a masterful job. I'll make that our pick because that's a two credit pick. So if you go to audible.com/twit2, you can get two credits, make it this long book. And long is right. 32 hours and 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And
that's faster than I read it.
Yeah, probably is. Oh, I loved that book. And I've already read it in print, but I've downloaded the Audible version to listen to it.
This is my problem. See, I see why I don't read a lot of fictional books. The idea of taking 100 pages or 250 pages is just, I can listen through that. You know, I could listen, you know, while in the background, but I can't read that long.
Audible. Well,
it takes the length of a book to get into it, but then you'll love it.
You'll love it at the end. You'll be sorry it ended.
Yeah.
That's Tom Wolfe.
Really will.
For me, that's Tom Wolfe. I'll get to the end. I go, boy, I hated that book, but I'm sorry it's over. Audible.com/twit2 is the URL for it. We thank Audible so much for their support. I did see that online, this is weird, this is contrarian, online advertising was up this quarter.
I think that's predictable.
I saw that too, yeah.
You thought that was predictable?
You know, I think before the bottom fell out, sure.
Well, but that's this quarter.
Well, I think that we're going to, I mean, I really...
It's going to keep going up, or is...
I think it's going to keep on going up.
It can't go down. It's like the housing market and the dot-com.
Oh, it was already so low. I see.
Well, but I also think that, you know, I was talking to a head of marketing for a hotel chain, and they were saying that, you know, they just keep on increasing their online budget. And especially as things get harder, they're pushing more there because it's more focused.
Your mouth to God's ear, Alex Lindsay.
No, but it's just that's the thing that people are focusing on, because now part of it has to do also with the maturity of the online market, where you're getting a lot of data back about what people are doing.
And boy,
what they're,
you compare that to advertising on Seinfeld. You have no idea.
You're shooting into the dark.
You might have 18 million people, but you don't know how many of them are.
And you really don't know if it's 18 million. I mean, it's an extrapolated sample.
That's another problem with podcasts. You don't know people listen to it. You know they downloaded it. You don't know.
I think that's more certain than TV.
I think a lot of advertisers use that newness to their advantage to get a better deal.
They do. Not with us, though. Well, we tell them, too bad.
There's
sorry.
A couple of other things, too. I mean, as the market has gone the way that it has, advertising online is more affordable. And then, you know, what you're also seeing is consolidated ad networks working with larger sites that are giving greater discounts. So, you know, what was a good deal before is becoming an even better deal now. In terms of, you know, on a CPM and right. you know, cost per eyeball basis, you know, online advertising is by far the best bang for your buck.
Another reason for PC Magazine to abandon print and go online.
Absolutely. But the trick is, I mean, you know, is this all of this advertising going to go to larger online media companies, or is there going to, you know, still be a larger boon for some of the smaller players in the space? And I think that's the question.
Yeah, that is in fact, I agree. The question, because what's happening is they've been shifting money into online for a long time. I mean, that momentum has been building up for a while. So it's no surprise, as Alex says, that this has not changed. As the pot shrinks, they're still shifting money into online, and if it's a better deal, they're going to keep shifting more money to get a better deal. And that money so far hasn't been going all in one place, but it has, I think, favored some of the more established places because the agencies are just comfortable with dealing with them. I mean, we haven't at CNET. I don't work with the salespeople all that often, so I don't know exactly what's going on. But I know that the clients we've been seeing are the similar clients that we've had for a long time because they're comfortable with it. It's hard to get new clients.
Yeah, I think that what you're likely to see, especially as online advertising grows in some ways, I don't think it's going to grow in all ways. I don't think it's going to be an outward expansion in all directions through this recession. But I think that what you will see is that big advertisers will begin to consolidate and work with the larger, more reputable sites and networks. And the smaller guys, I don't want to say, the FMs and the publishers who are using FM, but, I think the smaller sites are going to feel the pinch harder because they're going to be viewed as a little bit riskier. And they're not going to have the economies of scale that a CNET would, with millions of pages
a
day.
I've heard that said about blogging in general, which is that blogging was originally this great flowering of individuals writing their thoughts on online and finding an audience and a voice. And I've heard that said that the big ones, the Engadgets of the world, are going to kind of swallow.
But that's the reality of any big growth. I mean, it's just what happens everywhere. I mean, we started doing railroads, 120 years ago, 130 years ago, and it blew up, and there were little railroads everywhere, and then eventually there were three.
Yeah.
And then
actually all three went out of business after the Transcontinental Railroad. There was a big bust.
Right.
Very much like the dot-com bust, and we started over.
I can't speak specifically to how things have been with Engadget since I've left over the last few months, but I do know that the margins on a lot of publishing houses are so high, your Gawkers and your Weblogs Inc. and so on, that even as profits start to get churned through the recession and it is a little bit harder to secure larger online advertising deals because the margins are so high, it's not as challenging for somebody like Engadget, for a publication like Engadget, to kind of stick this thing through. So,
aren't some of the publishers didn't a bunch of people at Valleywag get laid off? Isn't Gawker kind of struggling a little?
Yeah, you want my personal opinion about that? Valleywag has been struggling for a very long time. It was at the bottom, or maybe second to the bottom, in Gawker's entire network. So it was a really easy opportunity for Nick Denton to blame the economy on what was essentially a failed property.
I think we're seeing a lot of that right now, which is people laying off people. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to put words in. I'm not going to say, for instance, Jason and Mahalo or Revision 3, but I have to say, this is a great opportunity if you wanted to lay off people to do and blame it on George Bush.
Well, the venture capitalists are telling their companies, I read this in The Economist, they're saying, you need to cut your costs right now. They're feeling the pressure from their backers.
Yeah. All right. So blame it on the VCs then. That's even better.
Yeah, why not? The Viet Cong.
But that's typically the first round. The first round is often, whether it's true or not, for a given company, those people are, whatever they're working on isn't as successful as everything else. The next round is muscle. That's usually the
muscle.
The next round of layoffs will be muscle. It'll be stuff that is working.
Oh, instead of fat, down to the bone.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I was thinking Sopranos. I thought, I'm going to have to lay off Tito. I need my muscle, man.
Gawker and Revision 3 are going to be laying off their bouncers.
exactly. And then anybody can be on a show.
Anybody. Hey, how about the new Google? What do you think about this idea? The Google on Thursday started allowing people. And I noticed, by the way, for instance, Mike Arrington on TechCrunch said, whatever you do, turn it off. Don't use it. It's terrible. It's a bad thing. And they allowed users to eliminate search results. The kind of the wikification of Google. The changes won't affect anybody else, just you.
Well, here's the thing, though.
But they're going to watch them.
Right. I mean, this is an incredible amount of information being handed back to Google. It is crowdsourcing, people picking through and deciding, oh, that's bad. This stuff isn't good. And maybe they're not doing any with it now, but it's got to go back into the calculations over time.
Well, I admit that they're paying attention.
I mean, you think about it. This is a logical extension of the way that Google as a search engine works anyway. It's all about trying to learn what reputation means online.
Yeah, but do you want Google to be like Dig, where
I said
problems?
I said reputation. I didn't say voting or social bookmarking or anything like that. The way the PageRank works is it looks for and it calculates reputation and.
But this
and
is more like voting
based on. Yeah, well, I don't know if I'd say voting per se, and I don't know. I don't even know if wiki is the right word for it, because if you're the only person who sees it right now, then that's not exactly a wiki. Right.
Yeah, the guy who founded Wiki is mad because they don't call Google sites a wiki, but they call this a wiki.
The search wiki.
That's not even a wiki. But anyway.
So here's how it works. If you're logged into Google when you're doing a search, you're going to see results. There'll be buttons below the links. You can up arrow it, which moves the result higher on the page for you only. You can exit, which says, I don't want to see this one anymore. It is very dig-like, isn't it?
Yeah.
But why was Mike Arrington so personal?
That just affects your personal results.
But Mike Arrington hated it.
But it's going to be used as a It's going to be used as a contributing factor to people's ranks a year from now. I think that's fine because
it's just one variable in the algorithm. It's not like Dig, where that is the algorithm,
right?
Essentially, I mean, there's a little more to it than that, but votes are all dominant. I don't think that Google's going to go that way.
No, I agree.
It went away though, didn't it? Is it still there? It's coming and going or something. Cheers with Mike Arrington. Cheers were heard across the internet earlier today, November 22nd, when Google's new Search Wiki search interface inexplicably vanished. Perhaps just maybe it was gone for good, or at least when it returned, it would have an opt-out feature. Nope, neither. It's back. Now it's back.
He's decided
this is the bad thing. He says, whatever you do, don't use Search Wiki. Opt out. He says,
it doesn't matter. You don't want to use it. Don't use it.
He says, Google, wasn't broke. To mess with the real Google search is serious stuff. Why did they do it?
But
mess
with it all the time. It's an opt-in and it's out of the way. It's not something that's in any way obtrusive to what you're already doing.
Here's one.
It doesn't add clutter. It's actually really, I mean, they could have screwed this implementation up. And I'm not necessarily a huge fan of this service, but I mean, it's. I don't care what all the vitriol is about. I mean, it's not horrible.
Well, here's one thing that Mike says, and I don't know if it's true, but he says you can't. Once you turn it on, you can't turn it off. Is that true?
You can clear out the results. I don't know about turning it on.
I haven't turned it on yet, but
Clearing out the results is essentially the same as turning it off. I mean, if it's on and you don't use it after that,
right? Google killed Lively too. As long as we're talking.
Oh, I was so sad to hear that.
Still
for the first time.
I forgot what it was.
Lively. Yeah. What was it? It's like their 3D world, right?
It was their second life.
Kind of their take on Second Life. It was stillborn. At best, it was stillborn. I mean, it was just not.
By the way, it fell in our chat room. Says Google plus Dig is giggle. I like it. You can start the giggle engine.
Or Google.
Let's see here. Xbox 360. Love it or hate it?
Love it.
You love it? You must be a Wii guy.
Me?
You must be a Wii guy.
No, I'm really not.
I logged on to Xbox 360.
Small, or yeah, you mean the
your
Nintendo
Wii. Teeny weeny. No, because they've changed it now. They got the Wiivatars, or whatever you call them. The Wibbles. The Weebles.
They're a little bit better. They're actually right in between what you get with the Miis on the Wii and the Avatars on PlayStation Home, where it's enough customization that actually looks like you, but it's not so much customization that it's kind of like uncanny
but
valley.
But do Xbox 360 gamers want to look like a
Weeble? I don't think that they do. And that is not, I think, the crux of the new Xbox experience update that everybody got
on. First thing you see and the first thing you got to do is customize your Weeble.
Yeah, but once you're done with that, it's pretty much out of the way.
Yeah, I was done with that, is right.
So you've got Netflix integration now, which is great.
That's very cool.
The new interface is really nice. It's a lot more streamlined. Downloading things is a lot more streamlined as well. Everything seems a lot faster. You can offload games to the hard drive, so they load quicker.
Oh, that's nice. That's really nice.
You're not running the game off of the disk anymore, which it saves power. It's a lot quieter, and like I said, it's faster. They have a new party system, so you can this is something I've really
it's pretty funny. You can look at somebody's Weeble and then say you want a party, and to me that seems like you're I don't know. what does partying mean?
Basically, it means like you can get a bunch of your friends and be playing a multiplayer game at the same time.
It's like a World of Warcraft party. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I'm not a big WoW player, but it's something that Xbox has always lacked because you can only do like a one-to-one chat.
Right.
So say you're playing a 10-person multiplayer game, and it's just you and your friend, and then you can't communicate with the other eight people because you're in private mode. Right. But say you want to have, four or five people and you want to play together, but you don't really want to deal with any of the other people, which is frequent on Xbox because there's a lot of douchebags. So the party system kind of resolves that where as it becomes supported in more games, you can jump from game to game with a persistent group of people and, kind of have that private chat with your friends and your friends only, and not really have to deal with anybody else.
Tom, have you watched the Netflix movies on the Xbox 360?
You know, I tried it out just to see what it's like. I reactivated a trial subscription. I don't actually pay for Xbox Live Gold.
I have to pay for Gold. What is that? I'm already paying Xbox like $25 a month.
It's a kind of a pain because if you want to use the Netflix, you have to be a Netflix subscriber with a plan
and
support. But I have the Roku player, and I... Other than high def, which is a big difference, there really isn't that much of an advantage to using Xbox. But
so
while,
the Roku player,
while the
I have
Roku doesn't have high def,
it's getting
I think
it
the Xbox has a big advantage.
Now, the Roku player is going to be getting high def soon.
As soon as Roku gets Hulu and possibly, I think they're talking about Amazon and the high def, then that Roku player is a pretty nice item at $99.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
Do you have the Roku player?
No, they sent it to somebody who works for me and then wouldn't send it to me.
I said you already have one.
I said, but I don't get it. I could buy one. Yeah, $99.
It's only $99.
I think I could afford it. It's cheaper than Xbox Gold.
I'm just really wondering whether this is really going to be. I mean, when you start seeing between the Xbox through the Roku through Apple iTunes, whether we're really going to be buying Blu-rays.
I brought in a show and tell item because I brought in the New York Times Magazine. Which is the whole issue, how we watch stuff, it's all about screens, HDTVs, smartphones, laptops, iMacs, computer monitors, nanos, Kindles, bus shelters, airplane seatbacks. The whole issue is about the fact that all of this entertainment is being dispersed out to every device. And, of course, they have an interview with David Lynch, one of those little quickie things, and he hates the little screens.
The little screens are horrible.
Did you know that David...
Yeah, design a movie for a little screen.
But did you know that he does a daily weather report from his house on his blog? A little YouTube-y weather report?
He just doesn't want people watching his films on an iPhone.
That's right. I don't want to watch his film. Have you seen Mulholland Drive? I don't want to watch his films on anything. Piece of junk that was. God, I love Blue Velvet, but boy...
Heineken!
Heineken, I bought one.
I won't continue.
Yeah. So,
good quote from Blue Velvet. Look it up.
Yeah. Heineken.
Pabst Blue Ribbon. the screens everywhere is interesting. I mean, they're at the gas stations now, too.
Absolutely.
With the live traffic reports.
They're in your grocery cart.
Oh, yeah. They're in your grocery cart? I haven't seen that yet.
That's one of the things they're putting, I don't know if it succeeded. Maybe it was one of those things that came and went. It's like Peapod, but for a while they were putting videos in the grocery ads in your grocery cart. So here's the thing. I mean, President-elect Obama's putting his address on YouTube. I mean, clearly the world is changing in a very dramatic way. And the fact that the New York Times spends a whole New York Times Sunday magazine on it tells you something. Of course, maybe it's just so they could have all the DVD ads.
Right. It was just a good moneymaker.
Profit deal.
The other thing that you may not have seen is New York Times also this week launched a gadget blog.
Did they?
Really, really funny. I don't remember what it's like. Gadget View, Gadget Scene, something like that.
GDGT.
I don't want to say it's not well written because it's New York Times. They do a pretty good job, but the idea of anybody launching a gadget blog in 2008 seems pretty hilarious to me because that land grab was over years ago.
Well, so you're saying GDGT is not a gadget blog?
Yeah, we've said that many times already. Okay. We're not. Peter and I are not launching another gadget blog. I mean, Peter, did Gizmodo before Engadget, and I did Engadget with Peter. So, between the two of us, we launched and cultivated the two most popular gadget and technology blogs on the internet, at least at the top of that pile. And I don't have any real reason to want to do that again. We want to try something new.
I stand corrected. It's not a gadget blog. It's a consumer electronics site.
Yeah, it's going to be a gadget and consumer electronics site, but we're not focusing on blogging and news.
Ah, okay, I get it. Yeah. Well, the podcast is hugely successful. I mean, that's a hell of a start. I mean,
well, it's no twit, but we do what we can.
GDGT Weekly is at gdgt.com. Boing Boing started a gadget blog too. But Boing Boing started. What did they?
Yeah,
they launched something else new this week. What did they just?
Yeah, they did a video game blog too.
That's bizarre. That's another example of something. Why are you launching something now?
A little bit weird to see that at this point, because again, it's not like that there's any shortage of video game publications and sites out there.
Right.
Well, with Boing Boing, when they started the Gadget thing, I took it as taking the Gadget posts that they already made, because they did make them, and sort of putting them together in one place. I guess you could make the same argument with the New York Times.
They hired a dedicated staff specifically for Gadget sites. So, I mean, they're trying to make Boing Boing Gadgets its own publication. They have Joel Johnson. You know, he was.
If your gadget posts are real popular, though, that's a good idea.
Well, and maybe they're responding to this whole thing that we were just talking about, which is that the day of the individual blogger is over. If you want to, and let's face it, even though Boing Boing has five contributors or whatever, it's still kind of the one thing. So if you're going to continue in this world, you have to be a network of blogs, right? Is that right? Can you succeed as I guess Boing Boing succeeds
pretty well. It helps. I mean, first is finding a niche that works and that you can really cover the hell out of. And if I was starting a blog now, I would be trying to find that niche.
And it wouldn't be gaming, and it wouldn't be gadgets.
Right. I mean, those have been done. And that, frankly, they're not really niches anymore. I mean, in 2004 and in 2002, when respectively, when Engadget and Gizmodo were started, they were still niches. Gadgets was a niche. People were still kind of getting up to speed, and owning a cell phone and a digital camera wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now. And the market has really changed since then. But I mean, the niche has gone from gadgets, which is, you know, what we think of now as being a very broad spectrum, to something a lot more narrow. And so that's, I think, the first thing that you've got to do if you're starting a publication today is pick something a little bit more.
Find a new one, and don't do a tech news roundtable.
I think you have more people.
Can possibly be about that.
Right.
But I think you also have people who want to have that. You know, they want to hear from the people who are posting there. Or what their opinions are, but they want to hear it in a specific track. I know that, you know, we found with MacBreak, for instance, there were things that we wanted to cover that, you know, like developer stuff or stuff for Final Cut Pro Studio. If we put that in the main feed, people would go, well, where's the stuff about about my iApps?
Right.
You know, so we've been slowly kind of cutting up into wider gamuts within that one area. But that's just to satisfy, so people have their own, they can watch their own, the feed that's specifically interesting to them, but it comes out as a separate unit.
Smart thing that you've seen over the past couple of years, especially with regard to the gadget world, is it went from gadget blogs to, you know, specific gadget blogs. So it went from Gizmodo and Engadget, you know, sites that covered gadgets with a capital G, to, you know, the Zune blog and the iPhone blog, you know, specific, like super niche. We're only covering one product or one line of products.
That's too niche.
So, I mean, I think that's one way of doing it. But yeah, I mean, to kind of take this back, I mean, the New York Times doing a gadget blog at this point seems really, I don't know, kind of desperate maybe. I mean, like they're grasping for relevance, and we know how poor they've been doing financially over the past couple months. I just don't know.
Or is it that gadget, like you say, that gadget category is such a broad thing that it's now up there with, you know, close to sports and real estate and cars. It's a section of the paper you got to have.
Right.
But they already have Bits, you know, the fact that they're doing.
Well, and they've kind of killed Circuits, which was their tech.
Yeah, Circuits became Bits.
But it was.
I mean, it's funny how they did that.
It was more granular. You had Circuits, now we're just down to Bits.
Right.
I'm surprised they didn't go from Circuits to Bytes and then to Bits.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
We're going to take a break, come back. We'll talk about, the New York Times has announced it's okay for teenagers to socialize online. Turns out it's good for them. Thank goodness. Oh, what Verizon did and did not do to President-elect Obama's cell phone account. And the Pentagon bans flash drives. But before we... Well, it's about time.
Yeah.
Before we do that, I want to mention our good friends at GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting.com/twit. GoToMeeting is something I've been using for years. I started using it because my good friend Ed Iacobucci started the company Citrix, a great company, and I was a big fan of Ed. And Ed knew remote access better than anybody. I mean, he really knew this stuff. Of course, GoToMyPC is one of their products. I've been using that for years. GoToMeeting is for online meetings. So if you're in the situation, and I think everybody is nowadays, where you want to eliminate air travel for a meeting, you don't want to drive across town even for a 10-minute meeting, you're doing more conference calls. But the problem with conference calls,
problem I'm having right now. I see Alex Lindsay's start pulled out to field runners, and he's gonna play the game while I'm and you can't tell. You're on the conference call. You know they're doing their email. They're chatting with their girlfriends. They're not paying any attention. That's why GoToMeeting is so useful for an online meeting. With GoToMeeting, you engage people. Here's how it works. Now, you can do it ahead of time. In fact, it works very nicely with Outlook. Works on the Mac and the PC, by the way. So you just click a link and you send an email out saying we're going to have our conference calls at 2:30. And here's the link to click when you get there. Or you can do it while you're on the phone. You say, hey, look, just go to gotomeeting.com. Type in the meeting ID. They don't have to install any software. It's very easy for them. All of a sudden, right there on their screen, they're seeing your desktop. So they're seeing your PowerPoint. You show them the website, the drawings, whatever it is you're working on. You could collaborate together. You could say, okay, let's work on this paragraph, and they work together on it. I used it a couple of weeks ago for a speech that I was giving. We actually rehearsed the speech over GoToMeeting and the PowerPoint slides, and it's all in real time, so you really can do that. It just takes 2 minutes to set up. I want you to try it right now. Go to gotomeeting.com/twit, and you could try it absolutely free for the next 30 days. A month of unlimited online meetings. Mac and PCs, they now have VoIP built in, which is very cool. You don't have to use a conference call service. It's all part of the price. One low, flat monthly rate. As many meetings as you want, as long as you want. GoToMeeting.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. It's a great product. I've known these guys for years, and I believe in what they do, and I think you will love it. GoToMeeting.com/twit. Moving along, the Pentagon bans flash drives. I don't know.
It's, why were they letting them use flash drives in the first place?
I don't understand it. The use of external computer flash drives because of a virus threat detected on Defense Department networks. Well, you got to think, guys, pay attention. Defense officials would not publicly confirm the ban. This is from the Associated Press. Messages were sent to department employees informing them of the new restrictions. As part of the ban, they collected any of the small flash drives that were in the building, and they
were issued by the Defense Department.
Yeah, we gave you these drives. We're taking them back, and we're not giving them back to you.
You know, these kinds of devices have been banned or blocked throughout various levels of government, and you know, in the corporate sector too, for years. This is not a new thing. You know, camera phones are clearly one of those bits that have always been a point of contention. I mean, really, look, here's the bottom line. You can't expect to keep security by taking away flash drives.
but it's a good start. It's something you should be doing. I mean, these U3 drives.
Really?
What you got to do is either just let everybody, you know, free for all, bring everything that they want to bring in, or take everything away at the door and completely remove all risk of any kind of, you know, device security issues whatsoever.
Yeah, take away the local drives.
Put that one device in, and that device can do anything. I mean,
what else do you do? I guess you could firewall. You could have the employee network completely firewalled off from your secure network. I'm sure they must do that.
They should probably teach the people what the problem is and why you shouldn't be putting certain USB drives into the computers, because banning the USB drives is not going to solve the entire problem either if somebody goes and plugs one in anyway.
Well, so really,
it takes multiple approaches. Education isn't going to solve it. A firewall isn't going to solve it. Banning the USB drives, you got to pull out all the stops.
Well, I think, and also net or thin clients, you know, that's when I worked at Industrial Light and Magic, 90% of the company couldn't really share anything because everything was running through these Unix machines that were, you know, everything was running from a central, everything was being shared out, and you couldn't really plug anything in to pull anything off. Of course, we were part of the one little group that just had Macs. So they were always, if there was a leak, we were always the first ones that got talked to.
How did a virus get into the Pentagon? Actually, if you think about it, the Pentagon is a big employer. There's a ton of people in there. It's not just any old, you know.
Well, it was detected. It doesn't sound like it got very far. You know, it was like something got picked up. It doesn't sound like, but it obviously would have.
Well, and was this on a secure network that has no internet access, or is this on the wider Pentagon system? That's used by every level of clearance. Right. It's hard to say.
Don't know. Yeah. Verizon staff might have cracked into President-elect Obama's cell phone account, but they didn't listen to his voicemails. So that's a good news.
Apparently didn't have any. In the story I read, it said, well, they didn't listen to his voicemails. And then later in the article said, he didn't use this phone for, this phone didn't have
it doesn't only use this phone for anything. I mean, it was like, because it's not a BlackBerry.
Why did he even have this phone? Been deactivated or, something, or not in use for a number of months, if not years. So probably not a huge deal.
He changed, according to the New York Times, he changed cell phone numbers right at the beginning of the campaign. His cell phone number was fairly widely known. Changed cell phones, changed cell phone numbers. For good reason, for security.
Although, I mean, this speaks to that other article that came out about Obama, which is that he wants to be the first president to have a laptop and a cell phone on his desk. They kind of, at this point now, they take away all of your personal communications and devices and equipment at the door. Presidents aren't allowed to communicate directly with the outside world. And he doesn't want that.
It's like you're held hostage.
Kind of, right?
Explains a lot about the last 8 years, actually.
Well, the concept, and I get it, is that he should have people who are taking care of those low-level functions for him. And those are technically low-level functions.
He doesn't carry a wallet or cash either, right?
There's also the fact that, I mean, President Bush did this willingly. He said, I am going to set aside my email address because every email sent and received becomes part of the public record as a president. It becomes part of the presidential record. And so he took his G94W at AOL.com address and said, shut down. He emailed everybody in his address book. Sorry, folks, I'm not going to be using this for the next.
I don't think it's widely known, but he did keep the Bushmeister at Hotmail.com. And,
but the Decider at AOL.com.
Yeah, right.
It was interesting that his email address was given out by the New York Times.
G94W at AOL.com. It just cracks me up.
I know.
But he got a bad rap, in fact, as a president who wasn't using email. I think early on, a lot of us thought, oh, what a nitwit, he's not using email. But he, in fact, was using email. He just gave it up. And we talked about this a little bit last week, too, Obama giving up his BlackBerry. If you're putting some guy in charge of the free world, it seems like he should have access to a laptop computer. Seems like
you think he might want to be able to see things.
Well, I mean, again, the argument, not that I necessarily buy it, but it is an interesting argument. And that is that... you know, most communications are low level, and that if you're dealing with should be high enough level that they're worthy of your time as the commander in chief of the free world and blah blah blah. But yeah, you know, look, I don't really buy that. I think that that it's also important to have an unfiltered view of the world, and that doesn't mean, you know, what your staff chooses to show you. That means, you know, checking the blogs or checking the media and the newspapers and everything online, and, you know, communicating with actual people and not just your yes men that you're surrounding yourself with.
It's a really interesting
access
question.
It's access to web and RSS feeds as much as just being able to send a text message or an email to somebody. President's a really busy person. They need to be able to communicate in multiple ways.
I don't think that Obama minds that all of that, those communications become public record. I don't think that anybody's trying to change that policy. I think it's really just a matter of the policy of, you know, is he and should he be spending his time on these things?
Yeah. And Al Gore actually set up a governmental email address when he started his campaign in 1999, I guess, for the 2000 campaign.
He was
able to set that up, but it was limited.
No. It was different. He had his White House email address, and he kept it and used it. So it was like al.4@whitehouse.gov or whatever it was.
After he was out of office?
That as his official
campaign. Well, he was still vice president while he was campaigning.
Right.
But you're not supposed to use any... Well, you're certainly not supposed to, for instance, make fundraising calls from the White House or from the vice president's office. That's an interesting question. Are you allowed to use your governmental email address for campaigning?
Well, I think President Bush doesn't even have a governmental email address.
Right, right.
I could be wrong about that.
Well, there's president at whitehouse.gov, but I'm sure he's not reading it.
Well, yeah, okay, you're right.
I doubt he would. I wouldn't want him to be. I wouldn't really want him to be reading
that's
it.
That's like feedback at us.gov.
Yeah, right. Oh, man, this guy, you know, Larry Glass 99 doesn't like what I'm doing. I'm going to have to change my ways. You don't want him reading that. But and does Vladimir Putin or whatever, who's the new guy?
Medvedev.
Very good.
Very good.
Were you practicing that, Tom?
No, not really.
Does Ahmadinejad have a laptop on his desk? I mean, you know, you presume that the underlings.
Both Max Catholic and Das Protestant, what's Islam?
I don't know. Maybe BOS? I don't know. That's a good question.
Linux.
Linux?
Wage the jihad against against the oppressors.
According to the New York Times, actually according to a study, living and learning with the new media, teenagers socializing on the internet, not a bad thing. Now, as considering that everybody on this show and everybody listening to this show probably grew up, you know, as a geek. I didn't have the internet when I was a kid. We had rocks, but basically grew up as a geek. This isn't much of a surprise. A study describes new media usage of teenagers, and of course, it's huge. It's through the roof. It's a $50 million project on digital and media learning. 800 young people, they observed their online usage for more than 5,000 hours and determined that, you know, it's pretty good. They're getting to know each other. They're socializing. They're learning social skills. They're writing, which I think is fantastic. Even if it's, you know, AOL, ROFL, POS, that kind of thing. Online socializing is ubiquitous. Many young people move on to a period of tinkering and exploration, like Kevin Mitnick, as they learn to look for information online, customize games, or experiment with digital media productions.
While this is not news.
No, but it was.
I guess it's confirmed.
It's news for it's the straight study. World. What the study calls
straight world.
The straight world. The straights. Hey, get used to it. We're here. We're geeks. We're proud. What the study calls geeking out is the most intense internet use, in which young people delve deeply into a particular area of interest, often through a connection to an online interest group. New media allows for a degree of freedom and autonomy for youth that is less apparent in a classroom setting. Youth respect one another's authority online, and they're often more motivated to learn from peers than adults. It's all a good thing.
They respect one another's authority online?
The MacArthur Foundation got that one wrong.
a trip through a local forum would seem to disprove that, but maybe that's all the 30-year-olds that are doing all blaming, and the young kids are actually tired of
They're
it.
They're learning how to get along with others, how to manage a public identity, and how to create a homepage. Not in that order.
Yeah, GeoCities, no less.
Yeah, and they're also way more than any teenage group ever before. We're going to wrap it up. Anybody else have any other stories before we table this endeavor? It's silence. Everybody's in the mood to head out to the pub. Tom Merritt is heard every day. You really, it's good of you to show up on the show, Tom, because you talk about tech news like every other day. So I appreciate you doing that here with us.
I enjoy it. I enjoy talking about technology, or I wouldn't be doing Buzz Out Loud. So I love getting the chance to talk about it with you and all the great folks you bring on, like Ryan and Alex.
It's always fun. BOL.CNET.com, a CBS joint. You can catch Tom there, and he's on CNET TV all the time, too, and really great. It's always good. Actually, watch BOL.com as the live place, right?
Yeah, that's when we record it. It's 10:30 Pacific, thereabouts. We stream it live.
I make sure that I'm not on the air till you're done. I leave my cameras off. Well, I don't want to compete with you.
Yeah, we don't want to compete with you either.
We carefully schedule
so
it.
So we appreciate that.
To avoid that. It's great to talk to you, Tom. Thanks for joining us. Mr. Ryan Block, the man in charge over, along with Peter Rojas of GDGT.com. Listen to their great podcast. We look forward to seeing what the... when do you have a launch date at all? I mean, is it...
that's the question of the
You're
hour.
Sick of answering that one, I'm sure.
No, look, it's a fair question. We haven't announced the launch date. We're working our asses off behind... Can I say that?
Yeah.
Is that okay to say?
Well, you did.
We're working as hard as we can to get the site out. We're not making any bones about the fact that it's pretty ambitious for us.
Great.
So,
Are you going to have a staff, or is it just going to be the two of you? Or,
things are a little bit in flux right now. We're just trying to get the site done, and we'll see how it all kind of shakes out later. But, like I said before, we're not looking to do news. We're looking to take on some larger problems in the gadget world online. And I appreciate everybody's interest and I can't wait to show off the site, but yeah, we're still in building mode right now. So,
I think it's a good time to start a new business, particularly of that kind. I wouldn't start business right now, but
left in gadget about I technically haven't really left in gadget. I'm still the editor at large. I still advise on the site and talk to those guys daily, but you know, I left my role as editor of the site, and AOL as you know, my full-time employer, about 2.5, maybe 3 weeks before September 15th, when the bottom fell out in the stock market and banks, collapsed. And So I had a moment of severe self-reflection.
What have I done?
Yeah, no,
wasn't
but you
it
know,
the
look,
news I'm, of you reducing your role that caused the market to start going
it.
Down in the first place.
You were the bellwether.
I sincerely doubt that. No, but yeah, I'm really excited about the site, and I hope people will be too, and you know, we'll be showing it around as soon as we possibly can.
Yeah, no, I'm not. No pressure, no hurry. We just look forward to seeing it. That's all. Everybody's very interested to see what you do. Yeah.
Every time I come on the show, it's you know, huge spike. Lots of people come check out our podcast. So it's always really nice to kind of get that Leo Laporte bump.
Well, frankly, that's what we do. We try to shed our listeners off to other people's podcasts because it's my goal in life to kind
I've got too many here.
Put myself out of business. You know,
it's good. No, I don't think anybody's coming to our show from you. I mean, all we talk about is gadgets and nothing but gadgets, and it's really, really hardcore gadget conversation.
I know, that's why I like it. Actually, everybody I've talked to who has found the podcast loves it. You're doing a great job with it. It's really, really well done. Yeah, and it's exactly what you were saying. It's that find a niche and really super serve that niche, and I think that's really the way to go. And assume an intelligence on the part of your audience and an interest instead of saying, you know, this is a gadget show for people who are kind of interested. No, no, this is for people really interested. That's the way to do it. Mr. Alex Lindsay, the man in charge of the Pixel Core. This is a good... Alex, I was talking to Alex the other day, and he said, I designed the Pixel Core for this economy. Yep. It's a good time to be a Pixel Corpian.
Yeah, it's... Well, I mean, it was... You know, you don't need to kind of group together as much when things are going well, but it makes a difference to have a group that you can work with in production and so on and so forth when things are getting a little sour.
Guild of Multimedia Artists. Yep. And you'll find out more about that at pixelcore.com. And, of course, the podcasts from Pixel Core, including This Week in Photography, which is great, twipphoto.com. But also all the podcasts are on pixelcore.tv. Don't forget, you can find us, of course, on iTunes. Dane keeps telling me, don't forget to mention people could download this show on iTunes. Okay. I thought most people knew that. But just in case, we've got over a dozen shows on iTunes. Or just go to iTunes, the iTunes store, and search for Twit. You'll find a bunch of stuff on there, some wonderful shows, including This Week in Tech and the radio show and Security Now and Windows Weekly. There's a lot of good stuff if you like technology. And we don't step on Ryan's toes. Our gadget show is just silly. It's the Daily Gizwiz with Dick DiBartolo. We thank you all for being here. We'll see you next week. Another Twit.
This is amazing.
Is in the can.
Round the horn.